the Business on RTE Radio 1 with AIB. You see it, we help you do it. AIB, for the life you're after.
Now, our next guest started out studying philosophy and French, but has since been named one of the 100 most influential women in finance globally. In a career spanning over 30 years, Nuala Walsh has found herself in Africa with the World Bank, entertaining presidents and moonwalkers. She is the founder and CEO of Mind Equity, which advises Fortune 500 companies, sports and human rights organisations. More recently, she has put on two new hats, that of behavioural scientist and author. Welcome to the show, Nuala.
Thank you very much, Anya.
We're going to come back to your incredible career in just a moment, but you've been listening to Donal O'Donovan beside you talk about Mike Lynch just now. And Mike Lynch isn't just the only former high-flying CEO we've seen in the news this week. We've seen the FTX founder Sam Bankman-Fried being sentenced to 25 years in prison. And your new book, Tune In, is about how we make bad decisions, how we can be better at making them. But, you know, Fried, Mike Lynch that we've been listening to, they're just two of many, many leaders over the years, high-flying entrepreneurs, ambitious moonshots. And very often we have seen some of those successful leaders make what could be called destructive decisions. In your learnings and in the book, do you think, you know, the more you win, the more you fear you're losing now as leaders in the current climate?
It's an excellent point. The more successful you are, the more you fall into this trap of the illusion of invulnerability, that you're never going to get it wrong. And it's exacerbated when you're surrounded by a team of sycophants or complicit bystanders who never speak up, who don't contradict, who merely just accept everything at face value. So I think there is a greater tendency now for people to try to at least speak up. But in today's world, I think you're right. Sam Bankman-Fried yesterday was an incredible example. 25 years, that was double the amount of Elizabeth Holmes, for example, who also Silicon Valley had conducted years of fooling the public with her false finger prick technology. And I think what we're seeing now is that more and more leaders are being held to account, actually. It was never the case before, but now what I've tried to do, certainly in the book, is to point out why this happens. I think it's very easy to rush to judgment and to say, well, it's a case of greed. Well, of course, greed is a component, but I've actually identified 10 different traps that people can fall into, particularly the more successful they are.
So, look, people, managers, leaders can make what might be called sometimes unethical decisions. But what about the folks sitting in the boardrooms, the advisors, those who are directors in a company? Do you think there is a little bit sometimes of deaf ear syndrome, as I think you have called it, that can happen when we see leaders like that making headlines?
It's 100% deaf ear syndrome. And that is really when people just hear what they want to hear. And the Elizabeth Holmes case is a classic example. The people in the boardroom weren't qualified enough to actually
And remind opine. People of Elizabeth Holmes. Theranos.
Elizabeth Holmes was Theranos, Silicon Valley, and she wanted to be the Steve Jobs of Silicon Valley at the time. And, you know, you've got to always consider the context when people make these decisions. It's easy for us to opine and judge now, but actually when people are in this context. But anyway, she falsified this technology for testing blood for a number of years. She was feted by Fortune, by all of the media, as being the next Bill Gates, actually, or not even Steve Jobs. But anyway, so she is an example of somebody who finally got caught out, but she suffered motivated reasoning. She was so tunnel visioned. So she had this illusion of invulnerability that she would never get caught. She had motivated reasonings, but she was surrounded by the in-group effect as well. So everyone in her peer group also, I think, played a really important part as well. So it isn't just one thing. It's ego. It's the context. It's the narrative around the environment that you're in. I have actually identified about 75 different biases that you can attribute this to.
And we'll come back to some of those biases and how we can all listen better as leaders or even in our personal professional lives. But I want to go back to your career starts in life. So you started out in Templeogue in Dublin. But I think it's fair to say, in an incredible career, right from the get-go, you were someone that was unafraid of trying different things, being curious, be led by what you were interested in, and not to get pigeonholed. Is that a fair assessment?
Well, it probably is. I think it's very easy to look back and to apply a rational evaluation of what you do. I was never destination driven, if that makes sense. But I suppose the one thing that I always did, I never turned down an opportunity. So wherever I saw it, whether it was in my workspace or something came, I always made the most of every opportunity that came along. And even if it was quite out of my reach, but almost there, I would always go for it. I would always try and make the opportunities happen. A small example, you mentioned the World Bank earlier on. I was working in PA, very early career. The financial services practice were doing work for the World Bank. I wasn't in that group, but I wanted to. And so I offered to, for example, to give up my 2 years training to be a bag carrier and go on that trip to DC. So I went to DC and my reward was, OK, we've got the pitch. Now you're going off to Africa for a year. So I took that opportunity.
And that was a life-changing moment for you, because you went to Tanzania and realised, actually, I want to do something else here. What was the decision? What was the insight?
Well, actually, when I was in Tanzania, I was currently doing forensic psychology at the time. And what it did was I decided I didn't want to stay in Tanzania for a year. What happens is you become a career consultant because you can't get people to basically stay there. So I went, then I moved into the city. So I left and I went into the city and I joined Merrill Lynch. But a really good learning is that everything is a springboard. Because I was in Tanzania, years later, I got onto the board of UN Women because they saw that it was ActionAid and then UN Women. So everything is a catalyst. But I really do think that this point about taking the opportunities and maximising whatever your role is, whatever opportunities are there, and try and push it that little bit further.
And saying yes to those opportunities did bring you, you were, as you say, in DC, you're in Africa, you go to Merrill Lynch, you're working in finance and the investment management business. Investment banking can often be a tricky, sometimes toxic environment. What was your experience?
Well, actually, I would say it was a toxic environment. Investment banking is slightly different to investment management. Investment banking is fast paced. They reward decision makers. It's a very self-oriented world. When I moved actually to BlackRock, they were genuinely team oriented. And that was quite hard because I transitioned from Merrill Lynch, which was me, myself and I all the time. No offence to Merrill Lynch. I did love the brand Merrill Lynch. But that is the culture. It's an investment banking culture, whereas BlackRock had a much more team oriented approach. So it can be toxic, but I think it's all down to the leaders. And I think before that might have been permitted, in today's era with the cancel culture, there is no more room for that kind of behaviour, because you will be called out. And as we've just been saying, people are increasingly being held to account. And boards, from a governance perspective, anyone sitting on a board now is under more and more scrutiny. The regulators are really watching boards and making sure that, as in that position of power, making sure that you don't rush to misjudgment, that you do analyse the decisions that are made, and you're much more conscious of human behaviour. The problem is, as you alluded to, is that when you do reach these positions of power, that you think you are invulnerable. You think that it'll never happen to you. Every great leader can make good decisions and bad decisions, and we've seen the mighty fall, and you write about it and you read about it all the times in the paper now.
So, in all of this, you had at this point done psychology, financial management, but you also tried marketing. And the whole world of marketing brought you into incredible opportunities, including the Ryder Cup. What was your architecting there when it came to getting involved with a huge sports brand?
Well, it probably goes back to that point about opportunities. I was head of marketing for one of the investment companies, and we wanted to build the brand. So in order to make my job a little bit more interesting, I decided, well, let's go to you know, sponsor some of these sporting events. So the Ryder Cup was a fantastic opportunity. And actually, we did the deal. It was a record deal. We did it in about eight weeks, both sides of the Atlantic. But that, again, was a springboard. So I moved on then to sponsor the British and Irish Lions. Today, I sit on their board, and the Football Association. So what I learned was that even in the world of investment management or whatever job you're in, I try to build out my marketing world to do more interesting things.
And so, yeah, you're involved with lots of different sports boards, including, I think, you're involved with the British and Irish Lions, World Athletics, Football Association. but you're not of sports. But it's an important reminder, isn't it, that we can have single transferable skills and experiences that are relevant to different industries.
It's a really good point. I think we get we narrow ourselves. Other people don't narrow us. Other people actually embrace our difference more than we think. So some of the boards that I'm on, I am the outlier, and I am definitely, I'm not in the out group, but I am an outlier in terms of the experience. But what I've learned is that when you get the right leaders who have an open mind, they do embrace difference and they do embrace people to come on their board. So, for example, on the Football Association, I'm the only non-footballer, non-coach, non-referee on the team. But they like the cultural background and they like the fact that I do bring difference. And I think companies need to be applauded for that.
And it's lots of lateral thinking. And I imagine you sit at those boards asking powerful questions, which I think is what happened when you had the opportunity to sit beside Neil Armstrong and ask him curious questions. What happened there?
That's a good memory, to be fair. Well, as I said, in that role, that marketing role, I did try and expand the boundaries and we held fantastic events. And one year, I did have him at an event in one company and I didn't get to sit beside him at dinner. So fast forward 5 years, I moved companies and guess who was on my top list for being invited? Well, and Mr. Armstrong very kindly came, and he doesn't come very often, Anya. You know, he is a recluse. So I was terribly privileged that he answered.
How did you convince him?
I wrote him a letter. I had his email. I wrote him a letter and I felt I knew his personality. I felt I knew the personality of the new company. He doesn't like to be exposed, or didn't. He really values academic excellence, engineering, and he's an introvert. So anyway, I think I just convinced him that, you know, we would look after him well, and, you know, I explained what the personality type of the new CEO and the new company, and I felt it was a good fit.
Were you impressed by him?
Do you know, I was hugely impressed by him. He, if I was to think of any leader, he is the most modest man there was. And when I sat at the dinner, I felt like I was actually the journalist. I didn't drink. I had about, because I didn't get to speak.
You had a list of questions.
I had a list,
didn't you?
I did. I had about 10 or 12 questions under the table. I said, well, I've asked him this and I've asked him that. And I know that if there were other people there, they'd be asking about the thrust power, you know, of the Apollo 11 mission and everything else. I wanted to understand the person. And I really did. I wanted to know about the conspiracy theories, about him as a family man, and everything else, and his leadership style. So I kind of wrote down my own questions that I wanted.
What was your one big learning about him?
My big learning was probably a bit like Condoleezza Rice, maybe, is that he was true to himself. He didn't care about, and I know everyone writes that he doesn't care about the notoriety and the fame, but he actually didn't. When I asked him what he was most proud of, he said that it wasn't the Congressional Medal of Honor, it wasn't being first man on the moon, because he actually hated that. Buzz Aldrin wanted that title, but anyway. So what he valued most was how he was able to derive a mathematical principle from a mathematical formula from first principles, and that meant, and then he got an accolade from his peers. So it wasn't the presidential honors. It wasn't all of that. It was peer recognition and the fact that he was able to work out this really complicated aeronautical formula. So that for me just said, you know, the man just didn't need the trappings that today we all fall into, you know, when we're all seeking fame and fortune and notoriety.
He sounds like an incredibly, humble, grounded individual. In all of that, taking all of that vast experience, you moved into the world of behavioural science, and I read somewhere along the way that, and it's in your book, lots of references to serial killer case studies over the years. And I wonder how that fitted into you trying to better understand leaders and managers and tuning in. Is it that some of the disengagement strategies that we see with criminals, is that something that we maybe don't realise is just stubbornly persistent in human nature in general?
That's really astute, actually, because that's exactly right. The moral disengagement that serial killers apply when they are conducting their heinous acts, they disengage from their victims, but they also like to take behavioural residue. They like to take mementos and souvenirs, etc. But in corporate life, so any, you know, fraudster or anybody that you know, we write about, any of the people who have been scandalised, It's the same principle. You're absolutely right. It's the same principle of human behaviour. There are eight different mechanisms, and you see it in the Nazi concentration camps as well. There are eight different mechanisms of moral disengagement. One is, you know, well, everybody's doing it sort of mentality, or you attribute or you dehumanise the people. It's only that group over there, or God made me do it, which I think the Yorkshire Ripper used that one. Ted Bundy was also particularly, even though he's a terribly clever lawyer and a good looking lawyer, which of course made people not suspect him, he also dehumanised his victims terribly as well. So it's not that I could write another book, you know, correlating exactly that point. So it's a very good point. But you hit on the central point, which is it's human behaviour. It can be a serial killer. It can be you and I. It can be a parent. It can be anybody.
Why don't more of us call it out? You talk about in the book whistleblowing that it's something like only 1.4% of employees ever blow the whistle and speak up. What stops them?
I did my thesis on whistleblowing, actually, and to analyse exactly that. It's a very long answer because there are so many different reasons. The problem is motivated reasoning and the consequentiality. The problem is that there was an Australian study done that showed that when people did speak up, that the vast majority lost their jobs. Some took their own lives. Many of them lost their whole careers. The problem is that in the previous last decade, that people don't do it because of the fear of the consequences. Now, today, it is improving slightly. Now, the more you celebrate people for speaking up, although there is a personal price to pay, I think they're deemed heroes in many cases. If you think of Harry Markopoulos, who you may remember from the Bernie Madoff case, he reported for 9 consecutive years his complaints. He wrote a memo with 29 red flags advising that this was that this was a Ponzi scheme. Nobody listened. He was in the out group because he was not Hollywood attractive by his own admission. And because of that, nobody heard him. But he identified it when the fund was six billion. It went to 65 billion. And the consequences, not just of, you know, the investors, but even Madoff's own family. I don't know if you remember, but the investors took their own lives, some of them, and so did Madoff's own son a year after he was caught.
So sometimes even when the 1.4% put their hands up, they blow the whistle. The problem is listening, as you say. And your book, Tuning, gets into the fact that there's only like 25% efficiency rate when it comes to listening. What would you say to listeners this morning, you know, going back to work into the office next week, of how we just listen better, maybe to our colleagues, our managers, but also probably in our day to day lives, like just actually listen intentionally?
You're right. It's not even listening, because even with the best will in the world, we do listen, but we can't because of our cognitive processing limitations. You actually only hear 25 even when you try. Even if you're aware of that now, it means that at least what you can easily do is take a process of ask questions and question answers. So 4 simple words, even if you do that, and it's in high-stakes situations. Obviously, you're not going to reinterpret what people say all the time, or you'd never make a decision, or you'd never move on. But in the decisions that matter, when you're making a high-stakes decision that either affects your life or somebody else's life, if you don't take that time, you are now in this fast-paced, noisy, visual, tone-deaf world far more likely to make mistakes than if you do it. So that's the whole
point. So do you think it's really, like we've often talked, you know, about move fast, think fast. Do you think increasingly we actually have to think slower, move slower, a little bit more intentionally? Like, how do we're listening better, but then how do we make better decisions?
The first thing is to actually decide you're actually going to do it. And in most cases, people don't decide they're going to do it because they think they do it well enough already. However, if when you become cognizant of doing this, if you apply, I've identified 18 or 19 easy, really easy strategies. The question is whether are you doing it as an individual, or is the organisation doing it, or societally, what's happening? When you magnify the consequences of not doing it, you see the importance of doing it. So I think people can do it really easily. You apply what I call decision friction, which is slowing down. And friction is normally bad. Like on the internet, no one wants friction. We don't want it to take too long to get out of a subscription. But otherwise, slowing down, applying this decision friction is one of the easy ways to do it. So ask questions and question answers.
Love it. Thank you so much for that, Nuala Walsh, and your book, Tune In, How to Make Smarter Decisions in a Noisy World is published by Harriman House. Thank you so much for joining us today.